Chapter 82. Sentence, along with 50 minor reformers who are in for 1 and 5 year terms. Thank you 1,000 times, Joe. You have praised me away above my deserts, but I am not the man to quarrel with you for that. And as for Livy, she will take your very heartiest statements at par, and be grateful to you to the bottom of her heart. Between you and Punch and Brander Matthews, I am like to have my opinion of myself raised sufficiently high, and I guess the children will be after you, for it is the study of their lives, to keep my self-appreciation down somewhere within bounds. I had a note from Mrs. Rev. Great Knee Tyler, yesterday, and called on her today. She is well. Yesterday I was allowed to enter the prison with Mrs. Hammond. A Boer guard was at my elbow all the time, but was courteous and polite, only he barred the way in the compound, quadrangular big open court, and wouldn't let me cross a white mark that was on the ground, the if-dash line one of the prisoners called it. Not in earnest, though, I think. I found that I had met Hammond once, when he was a Yale senior, and a guest of General Franklin's. I also found that I had known Captain Maine intimately 32 years ago. One of the English prisoners had heard me lecture in London 23 years ago. After being introduced in turn to all the prisoners, I was allowed to see some of the cells, and examine their food, beds, etc. I was told in Johannesburg that Hammond's salary of $150,000 a year is not stopped, and that the salaries of some of the others are still continued. Hammond was looking very well indeed, and I can say the same of all the others. When the trouble first fell upon them, it hit some of them very hard. Several fell sick, Hammond among them. Two or three had to be removed to the hospital, and one of the favorites lost his mind and killed himself, poor fellow, last week. His funeral, with a sorrowing following of 10,000, took the place of the public demonstration the Americans were getting up for me. These prisoners are strong men, prominent men, and I believe they are all educated men. They are well off. Some of them are wealthy. They have a lot of books to read, they play games and smoke, and for a while they will be able to bear up in their captivity. But not for long, not for very long, I take it. I am told they have times of deadly brooding and depression. I made them a speech sitting down. It just happened so. I don't prefer that attitude. Still, it has one advantage, it is only a talk, it doesn't take the form of a speech. I have tried it once before on this trip. However, if a body wants to make sure of having liberty, and feeling at home, he had better stand up, of course. I advised them at considerable length, to stay where they were they would get used to it, and like it presently. If they got out they would only get in again somewhere else, by the look of their countenances. And I promised to go and see the president, and do what I could to get him to double their jail terms. We had a very good sociable time till the permitted time was up and a little over, and we outsiders had to go. I went again today, but the Rev. Mr. Gray had just arrived, and the warden, a genial, elderly Boer named Du Plessis, explained that his orders wouldn't allow him to admit saint and sinner at the same time, particularly on a Sunday. Du Plessis descended from the Huguenot fugitives, you see, of 200 years ago, but he hasn't any French left in him now, all Dutch. It gravels me to think what a goose I was to make Livy and Clara remain in Durban, but I wanted to save them the 30-hour railway trip to Johannesburg. And Durban and its climate and opulent foliage were so lovely, and the friends there were so choice, and so hearty, that I sacrificed myself in their interests, as I thought. It is just the beginning of winter, and although the days are hot, the nights are cool. But it's lovely weather in these regions too, and the friends are as lovely as the weather, and Johannesburg and Pretoria are brimming with interest. I talk here twice more, then return to Johannesburg next Wednesday for a fifth talk there, then to the Orange Free State capital, then to some town on the way to Port Elizabeth, where the two will join us by sea from Durban. Then the gang will go to Kimberley, and presently to the Cape, and so, in the course of time, we shall get through and sail for England. And then we will hunt up a quiet village, and I will write and live edit for a few months, while Clara and Susie and John study music and things in London. We have had noble good times everywhere and every day, from Cleveland, July 15, to Pretoria, May 24, and never a dull day either on sea or land, notwithstanding the carbuncles and things. Even when I was laid up 10 days at Jaipur in India, we had the charmingest times with English friends. All over India the English, well, you will never know how good and fine they are till you see them. Midnight and after. And I must do many things today, and lecture tonight. A world of thanks to you, Joe dear, and a world of love to all of you. Mark. Perhaps for readers of a later day a word, as to what constituted the Jameson raid would not be out of place here. Dr. Leander Starr Jameson was an English physician, located at Kimberley. President Kruger Paul, head of the South African Republic, was one of his patients. Also, Lebengula, the Matabele chief. From Lebengula concessions were obtained which led to the formation of the South African Company. Jameson gave up his profession, and went in for conquest, associating himself with the projects of Cecil Rhodes. In time he became administrator of Rhodesia. By the end of 1894, he was in high feather, and during a visit to Angle, and was feted as a sort of romantic conqueror of the olden time. Perhaps this turned his head. At all events at the end of 1895 came the startling news that Dr. Jim, as he was called, at the head of 600 men, had ridden into the Transvaal in support of a road scheme for an uprising at Johannesburg. The raid was a failure. Jameson, and those other knights of adventure, were captured by the forces of Ampol, and some of them barely escaped execution. The Boer president handed them over to the English government for punishment, and they received varying sentences, but all were eventually released. Jameson, later, became again prominent in South African politics, but there is no record of any further raids. The Clemens Party sailed from South Africa the middle of July, 1896, and on the last day of the month reached England. They had not planned to return to America, but to spend the winter in, or near London in some quiet place, where Clemens could write the book of his travels. The two daughters in America, Susie and John, were expected to arrive August 12th, but on that day there came, instead, a letter saying that Susie Clemens was not well enough to sail. A cable inquiry was immediately sent, but the reply when it came was not satisfactory, and Mrs. Clemens and Clara sailed for America without further delay. This was on August 15th. 3 days later, in the old home at Hartford, Susie Clemens died of cerebral fever. She had been visiting Mrs. Charles Dudley Warner, but by the physician's advice had been removed to the comfort and quiet of her own home, only a few steps away. Mark Twain, returning from his triumphant tour of the world in the hope that soon, now, he might be free from debt, with his family happily gathered about him, had to face alone this cruel blow. There was no purpose in his going to America. Susie would be buried long before his arrival. He awaited in England the return of his broken family. They lived that winter in a quiet corner of Chelsea, number 23 Tedworth Square. To Rev. Joseph H. Twitchell, in Hartford, Connecticut. : Permanent address. % Shadow and Windus 111 T. Martin's Lane, London, September 27, 96. Through Livy and Katie I have learned, dear old Joe, how loyally you stood poor Susie's friend, and mine, and Livy's. How you came all the way down, twice, from your summer refuge on your merciful errands, to bring the peace and comfort of your beloved presence, first to that poor child, and again to the broken heart of her poor desolate mother. It was like you, like your good great heart, like your matchless and unmatchable self. It was no surprise to me to learn that you stayed by Susie long hours, careless of fatigue and heat. It was no surprise to me to learn that you could still the storms that swept her spirit when no other could. For she loved you, revered you, trusted you, and Glee Joe was no empty phrase upon her lips. I am grateful to you, Joe, grateful to the bottom of my heart, which has always been filled with love for you, and respect and admiration. And I would have chosen you out of all the world, to take my place at Susie's side, and Livy's in those black hours. Susie was a rare creature, the rarest that has been reared in Hartford in this generation. And Livy knew it, and you knew it, and Charlie Warner and George, and Harmony, and the Hilliers and the Dunhams and the Cheneys, and Susie and Lily, and the Bunces, and Henry Robinson and Dick Burton, and perhaps others. And I also was of the number, but not in the same degree, for she was above my duller comprehension. I merely knew that she was my superior in fineness of mind, in the delicacy and subtlety of her intellect, but to fully measure her, I was not competent. I know her better now, for I have read her private writings, and sounded the deeps of her mind, and I know better now the treasure that was mine than I knew it when I had it. But I have this consolation, that dull as I was, I always knew enough to be proud when she commended me, or my work as proud as if Livy had done it herself, and I took it as the accolade from the hand of genius. I see now as Livy always saw that she had greatness in her, and that she herself was dimly conscious of it. And now she is dead, and I can never tell her. God bless you, Joe, and all of your house. S50. C. to Mr. Henry 100. Robinson, Hartford, Connecticut. : London, September 28, 96. It is as you say, dear old friend, the pathos of it, yes, it was a piteous thing, as piteous a tragedy as any the year can furnish. When we started westward upon our long trip at 10:30 at night, July 14, 1895, at Elmira, Susie stood on the platform in the blaze of the electric light waving her goodbyes to us as the train glided away, her mother throwing back kisses and watching her through her tears. 1 year, 1 month, and 1 week later, Clara and her mother, having exactly completed the circuit of the globe, drew up at that platform at the same hour of the night, in the same train and the same car, and again Susie had come a journey, and was near at hand to meet them. She was waiting in the house she was born in her coffin. All the circumstances of this death were pathetic, my brain is worn to rags rehearsing them. The mere death would have been cruelty enough, without overloading it, and emphasizing it with that score of harsh and wanton details. The child was taken away when her mother was within 3 days of her, and would have given 3 decades for sight of her. In my despair and unassuageable misery, I upbraid myself for ever parting with her. But there is no use in that. Since it was to happen, it would have happened. With love, S50. See, the life at Tedworth Square that winter was one of almost complete privacy. Of the hundreds of friends which Mark Twain had in London, scarcely half a dozen knew his address. He worked steadily on his book of travels, following the equator, and wrote few letters beyond business communications to Mr. Rogers. In one of these he said, "I am appalled. Here I am trying to load you up with work again after you have been dray-horsing over the same tiresome ground for a year. It's too bad, and I am ashamed of it." But late in November he sent a letter of a different sort, one that was to have an important bearing on the life of a girl today of unique and worldwide distinction. To Mrs. H.H. Rogers, in New York City. For and in behalf of Helen Keller, stone blind and deaf, and formerly dumb. Dear Mrs. Rogers, experience has convinced me that, when one wishes to set a hard-worked man at something which he mightn't prefer to be bothered with, it is best to move upon him behind his wife. If she can't convince him, it isn't worth while for other people to try. Mr. Rogers will remember our visit with that astonishing girl at Lawrence Hutton's house, when she was 14 years old. Last July, in Boston, when she was 16, she underwent the Harvard examination for admission to Radcliffe College. She passed without a single condition. She was allowed the same amount of time that is granted to other applicants, and this was shortened in her case by the fact that the question papers had to be read to her. Yet she scored an average of 90, as against an average of 78 on the part of the other applicants. It won't do for America to allow this marvelous child to retire from her studies because of poverty. If she can go on with them, she will make a fame that will endure in history for centuries. Along her special lines, she is the most extraordinary product of all the ages. There is danger that she must retire from the struggle for a college degree for lack of support for herself and for Miss Sullivan. The teacher who has been with her from the start, Mr. Rogers, will remember her. Mrs. Hutton writes to ask me to interest rich Englishmen in her case, and I would gladly try, but my secluded life will not permit it. I see nobody. Nobody knows my address. Nothing but the strictest hiding can enable me to write my long book in time. So I thought of this scheme. Beg you to lay siege to your husband, and get him to interest himself and Miss John D. and William Rockefeller and the other Standard Oil chiefs in Helen's case. Get them to subscribe an annual aggregate of $600, $700, or $1,000 and agree to continue this for 3 or 4 years, unless he has completed her college course. I'm not trying to limit their generosity, indeed no, they may pile that Standard Oil, Helen Keller College Fund as high as they please, they have my consent. Mrs. Hutton's idea is to raise a permanent fund, the interest upon which she'll support Helen and her teacher, and put them out of the fear of want. I shan't say a word against it, but she will find it a difficult and disheartening job, and meanwhile what is to become of that miraculous girl? No, for immediate and sound effectiveness, the thing is for you to plead with Mr. Rogers for this hampered wonder of your sex, and send him clothed with plenary powers, to plead with the other chiefs. They have spent mountains of money upon the worthiest benevolences, and I think that the same spirit which moved them to put their hands down through their hearts into their pockets in those cases will answer here, when its name is called in this one. 638 There, I don't need to apologize to you, or to HH for this appeal that I am making. I know you too well for that. Goodbye with love to all of you. S50. Clemens. Lawrence Hutton is on the staff of Harper's Monthly close by, and handy when wanted. The plea was not made in vain. Mr. and Mrs. Rogers interested themselves most liberally in Helen Keller's fortune, and certainly no one can say that any of those who contributed to her success ever had reason for disappointment. In his letter of grateful acknowledgement, which follows, Clemens also takes occasion to thank Mr. Rogers for his further efforts in the matter of his own difficulties. This particular reference concerns the publishing complications which by this time had arisen between the American Publishing Company of Hartford and the house in Franklin Square. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.